Jackson, W266DR Waukesha, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Vicki Barker. 101 days to go before Election Day. CBS's Natalie Brand reports from the White House.
The vice president's campaign for president is holding what it's calling a weekend of action, trying to mobilize thousands of volunteers in the states that could decide the election. The vice president herself is off the trail today, but holding a fundraiser in Massachusetts while the Trump team revamps its campaign to take on Harris.
A failed vice president.
Former President Trump sharpened his attacks against Vice President Kamala Harris, speaking at a summit in Florida for conservative Christians.
Our task is to defeat socialism, to defeat Marxism, communism, to defeat the cartels, and that means defeating Kamala Harris.
Former President Trump is addressing the Bitcoin 2024 conference in Nashville today. Evacuation orders are out in four California counties as the Park Fire continues to devour thousands of acres. And in Canada, the historic mountain town of Jasper, Alberta, has been struck by a wildfire, which also devastated the surrounding national park.
Parts of the town are apocalyptic. The premier says more than 300, or about a third, of the buildings here were damaged or destroyed. More than 25,000 tourists and residents evacuated ahead of the flames, including John Clark.
What happened to your home?
It's gone.
Completely?
Yeah, it's gone. There's nothing to look at. It's a foundation. That's all that's left.
But he plans to rebuild. Jasper National Park is considered a crown jewel for Canada, much like Yosemite or Yellowstone.
CBS's Carter Evans reporting. It's the first full day of competition in the Summer Games in Paris. After last night's rain-soaked, star-studded opening ceremony, the BBC's Mariam Mashiri was there.
The flame was lit on a hot air balloon, which then flew up into the sky and is now hovering over the Paris skyline. The Eiffel Tower is beautifully sparkling and lit behind me. The ceremony has been something to behold, and it ended with an icon on an icon, Celine Dion, singing the most beautiful hymn à l'amour on the first floor of the Eiffel Tower.
Also at the Olympics, but not in Paris.
About 10,000 miles away in Tahiti, surfers will take part in the Olympic Games, taking on waves at the legendary surf spot Teahupo'o. Set in the South Pacific, this is the furthest distance between an Olympic venue and a host city in the Games' history.
CBS's Dana Jacobson in Paris. And Team USA's won its first medal, a silver in the 3-meter synchronized springboard competition for Sarah Bacon and Cassidy Cook. This is.
Think O'Reilly Auto Parts for all your car care needs. Get the parts and service you need fast from the professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. One in eight people in Wisconsin could find it harder to afford food under the U.S. House version of the Farm Bill. Mike Moan reports.
The Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, falls under the Farm Bill, which needs to be reauthorized by the end of September. House Republicans have blocked efforts to maintain White House authority to make non-inflationary adjustments to SNAP benefits. Megan Rowe with the group Opportunity Wisconsin says not having that option would put recipients at a disadvantage.
SNAP benefits help over 700,000 Wisconsinites afford food, which is one in eight people in our state. And so gutting this assistance would mean that these families have to make difficult choices.
The Congressional Budget Office says removing the provision would limit the scope of future SNAP increases by $30 billion. Advocates say that amounts to a large cut. Wisconsin Republican Congressman Derek Van Orden was called out for a recent committee vote to keep the option shelved. In a social media post, he accused Democrats of lying when saying the panel was cutting benefits. Suzanne Becker of the Feed My People Food Bank in Eau Claire says politics shouldn't come into play. She argues elevating SNAP levels as much as possible is a wise move.
We can never replace the impact that SNAP has on our neighbors. Nonprofits can't do that. We make a difference every day. We strive to. But this is a critical piece in making sure that all Americans have what they need.
Becker says her location sees a lot of demand among working families. Her team works with income-eligible clients to sign up for SNAP benefits, noting it's a lifeline for older populations. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, sunshine, highs in the upper 70s. Partly cloudy, 68 tonight. Slight chance of a thunderstorm for your Sunday with a high around 82. Scattered storms Sunday night, a low around 70, and a couple of thunderstorms possible on Monday. Otherwise, partly sunny with highs in the mid-80s.
It's 64 at our studios.
Pat Kreitlow.
On Monday, one of the doctors participating in Ride to Decide, a national bus tour, speaking out about the real physical danger of state-based abortion bans.
Up North News with Pat Kreitlow. Weekday mornings starting at 6.
The Shaw, WAUK, Waukesha's home for Nightlight with Peach Waba.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel. Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Jim Santel, and yes, indeed, I am your host again this weekend. This is our weekend venued, our weekly broadcast here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media throughout the state of Wisconsin and beyond as well. Every weekend, we do an analysis, a review, an examination, some consideration, some deliberation, even on the recent news events of our time in those areas of law and government and the aspiration for justice in America. Delighted to have you with me and my spectacular producer, Max, once again. We are coming to you from the broadcast studio here in Waukesha, but broadcasting once again throughout our listening area. Delighted to have you join Max and me for our discussion this morning. That includes, as always, your questions, your inquiries in particular about the subject matters that are on our academic syllabus, our agenda for this weekend broadcast, talking about exactly what that's all about in just a moment or so. For those of you who are new, those of you who are continuing listeners as well, you know that the name of our show, Amicus, a Law Review, comes from a legal term. Yes, that's right. It's derived, as you know now well, from the Latin. It's meant to describe a friend. Many of you will recall from your language studies and maybe even your proficient use of some Romance languages, ami, A-M-I, means friend. It's an individual, an organization, some entity that somehow assists or promotes understanding, appreciation, an assessment of some relevant issue that needs consideration, that needs some deliberation, that maybe even needs decision by a court or some entity, by some person, all sorts of applicability for the notion of ami or amicus. In the legal setting, it traditionally means just that as well. Often a friend of the court called amicus curiae, and that's an entity, a person, could be an organization, usually represented by lawyers, but doesn't have to be, who presents some information in the course of some litigation, could be civil, could be criminal, in some way assists the court in understanding some facts, some background information that's relevant to the decision that the court has before it. Often a part of briefs, memorandums submitted to a trial court, very frequently to an appellate court, and with great frequency to the Supreme Courts of our many states and territories, and to the federal Supreme Court as well, the United States Supreme Court in Washington, D.C. Amicus, a friend of the court. And also we'd like to thank here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media, friend to you as well, as we attempt to understand, to unpack, to deliberate on and assess these issues in the area of law and government and the aspiration for justice. Courts, a lot of our focus, but not exclusively, and that includes our syllabus today. Our syllabus, again, achievable, but as always, ambitious, going to consume not only our attention in this hour, but next hour as well, inviting you to join Max and me for our discussion in both hours, your schedule permitting. What is that syllabus all about on this weekend presentation of Amicus Larvae. We're going to begin, as we always do, with hot topics in the news. This one could not be more topical. Since we have gotten together last week, a major change, as you well know, in the political landscape of America, the political landscape is going to change not only immediately, but in the next several months. The landscape of the campaign for the presidency of the United States of America, a significant ballot change. The decision by our current president, Joseph Biden, not to continue his presidency campaign, but instead to defer to his vice president, her name, as you know well, Kamala Harris. And she has undertaken that assignment, that task, and has indicated and will be pursuing that nomination before the Democratic Party when it gets together for its convention in Chicago in just a few weeks. Along the way, an awful lot of people talking about this significant ballot change, anticipating sometime soon that Kamala Harris will identify her own running mate, the person that she is selecting to serve on her behalf, with her on the ticket, on behalf of the people of the United States of America as her vice presidential nominee. That decision could come anytime. But along the way, a lot of focus on whether or not this change in the campaign on the Democratic side is legal, whether it's constitutional, whether it's consistent with the law, and a specter out there of challenges legally to the change that has been accomplished by virtue of the decision by our current president not to continue his candidacy, and instead for the candidacy of Kamala Harris, now taking up great speed and great enthusiasm around the nation. Whether that has legal implications as well, the short answer is no. We're going to address some of these issues, some of the planned and present challenges to the notion that somehow this ballot change is unconstitutional, that it is contrary to law, contrary to what the expectations would be, even the rules of the parties. We're going to analyze that and debunk many of those theories out there as a part of our legal analysis of that news event of this past week. Then we're necessarily going to return to the Supreme Court. We are in the wake of those many decisions, about 60 of them altogether that we have talked about a lot during the course of recent weeks and months. In the wake of the issuance of those decisions, Supreme Court still active out there. We're going to spend some time talking about something that one of the associate justices, her name, Elena Kagan, said just this past week about this continuing thorny issue related to ethics and the applications of an ethics code, the establishment of a set of ethics principles for the Supreme Court not presently in existence. Elena Kagan speaking out at a Ninth Circuit Judicial Conference just this past week. We're going to talk about what she said. Very interesting things about her commitment to ethics on the Supreme Court, what the Supreme Court should do right now in the midst of its continuing issue in the eyes and the perception of many Americans about the need for ethics and an ethics code. She's also going to tell us about some other things related to the way that the court does its business. We're going to unpack all of that also here on Amicus Law Review. And then we're going to talk about the implications, the fallout, if you will, of these two major decisions, one on June 28th, the other one on July 1, one of them finding that indeed the Chevron doctrine no longer applies in America in our courts, no more deference to the wise and expert-based decisions of agencies, and also this immunity decision granting a huge amount of immunity, changing our Constitution with respect to the powers of what the Supreme Court describes as a very, very muscular, very, very powerful executive branch. We're going to talk this weekend about the congressional response to those major opinions, arguably the most important opinions of recent times, certainly the most significant decisions of this term. What is Congress doing in response to those decisions? Some major moves already to rescind, to turn back, to do what we sometimes refer to as fixes of those Supreme Court cases. We're going to talk about all of that as well. We're also going to talk about the impact of at least one of those cases, that is the immunity decision by the Supreme Court granting Donald Trump and candidly, present and future presidents, a huge amount of either presumptive, in some cases, absolute immunity from crimes committed in the White House, in the Oval Office, as President of the United States of America. We're going to talk about recent events of just this past week having to do with the implications, the effect of that immunity decision on one, two, three, four of those cases pending against Donald Trump in the state and federal courts around the country, two of them alleging election interference when it comes to the 2020 election, two of them unrelated to that, but also associated with his conduct before and after his presidency. We're going to talk about how all of those cases are impacted by what the Supreme Court did, and specifically what happened just this past week when it comes to challenges to what's going on in one of those cases before the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, and also challenges before a judge who presided over the criminal case there in New York. We're going to talk about the status of those cases and what we can anticipate coming up in the future. Then, principally in our second hour, a major focus on something else that has percolated up in a major way in recent times, especially this past week, and that is the Supreme Court focus presently and in the future in the coming term on transgender rights in America. We know that the Supreme Court has carved out an exception for privacy rights in the Constitution, but the standards, the principles the Supreme Court has articulated under Title VII, defining sex to include gender identity and sexual orientation, that remains in place. And the question now is, how do transgender rights, how do the rights of people, transgendered men and women, transgendered citizens, residents of our nation, how are they impacted by recent decisions coming out of the Fifth and Sixth Circuits, and also recently by the Nebraska Supreme Court as well? All of that going to be pursued this weekend on Amicus, time permitting. We're also going to talk about a couple of other matters pending in the appellate courts, the federal appellate courts in the United States of America, one of them having to do with limitations imposed upon phone services provided to rural and economically depressed parts of our country, a rule established by our federal government, and the impact of a decision by an appellate court to restrict, to limit the application of that rule. I'm also going to talk about another decision coming out of Florida that basically rescinds and rejects that formerly passed by the legislature, legislation sometimes called the Florida Woke Rule, the Florida Woke legislation that prohibited various things in the academic setting and in the commercial setting as well. A major decision just this past week to put at least part of that legislation in Florida on hold. We're going to talk about that as well, time permitting today. As always, inviting in our important omnibus discussion of these and many other issues, we invite your questions and your inquiries in particular as we take up this broad syllabus. That number, 844-967-2789, 844-967-2789. Max, my excellent producer, will also be monitoring our feed on the app. You can also drop a question, an inquiry to me and to Max on the Civic Media app and get those into our discussion. Looking forward to your contributions throughout our discussion this weekend here on Amicus, a Law Review. Again, we are anticipating your comments, your questions, your inquiries about all of this as we begin our discussion of major issues in the area of law and government and the aspiration for justice in America. That begins here on Amicus, a Law Review, with an analysis of what's going on with the ballot in America, what's going on with those ballots in states around the nation, what is happening with the change in the Democratic nominee, anticipated nominee. We'll talk about all of that and the legal implications of that as Amicus, a Law Review, continues here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media.
You're listening to The Shaw, WAUK. Keeping you informed, entertained, and connected to your local community. Here's Terry Barr with the Civic Media Radio Network.
It is a 1,200-mile footpath started in the 1950s and now running through 30 Wisconsin counties. The Ice Age Trails PR director, Melissa Pyrick, says one group of hikers describes it best.
They started in St. Croix Falls, so they kind of did this North Woods, which is very rural and rustic. And they said they couldn't believe once you get down into the southern part of the state, especially Dane County, all of a sudden it turns into prairies, and it's just beautiful.
The trail continues south to Janesville, then back to the northeast and up to Sturgeon Bay. It is also one of just 11 in the country designated as a National Scenic Trail. Learn more about it in your area at iceagetrail.org. Until next time, I'm Terry Barr.
You're listening to The Shaw, WAUK, Waukesha's home for Up North News Radio.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel, your host in this hour and also next hour here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. Wonderful to have you join Max and me for your questions and your inquiries about our syllabus today, beginning as promised with this focus now in our nation in the wake of the decision by the current president not to pursue his candidacy for the presidency and the assumption of that role by his vice president, Kamala Harris. She is plainly securing right now the delegates for the Chicago convention to nominate her as a Democratic nominee for the presidency. Certainly going to be in the race in the coming weeks and months, anticipating the election on November 5th here in the state of Wisconsin, beyond throughout our United States of America. Lots of questions now about whether or not this is legal, whether this is constitutional, whether this is contrary to law, and indeed a lot of that craziness advanced by people who know better, people who understand that indeed there's no there when it comes to challenging what is going on. We're going to unpack the reasons why these so-called challenges that may have been started already, continuing, at least in the media, arguably in state courts, maybe even federal courts around the country, challenging this change in the anticipated nominee for the Democratic Party. We're going to unpack that and explain why, in many, many ways, particular, legal, and factual, there's no there, and the allegations of some sort of legal impropriety are completely wrong. Advanced in some ways by people who know better and who should know better and who, in fact, are simply engaging in, charitably, bad civics, but frankly, an attempt to deceive America into thinking that there's something more here in particular. At the top of that list is the Speaker of the House of Representatives. His name, as you know, Mike Johnson. He is third in line for the presidency of the United States of America. Third in line, and in that capacity, as we have said, not only a huge amount of power when it comes to Congress and the House of Representatives, but also some responsibility, as we've advocated before, for responsible statements about how government works, about how the House of Representatives works, about how the federal government functions. And he continues on a regular basis, including this past week, to raise specters that are not there, ghosts about things that are not real. Just this past week, Mike Johnson, again, in his role as Speaker of the House of Representatives, has suggested both before and after Joe Biden dropped out of the race that there are some legal, as he called them, impediments in some states to a party switching presidential candidates, as the Democrats plainly are doing right now. There was not a single state election authority that has told media outlets here that Kamala Harris would face a ballot issue as the official nominee. We'll get back to that issue in just a moment or so. And in fact, the statements by the House Speaker are simply wrong. What he said just this past Sunday, as Joe Biden was removing himself from the candidacy, was this. He said, it would be wrong. It would be wrong, he said, and I think unlawful, in accordance to some of these state rules, for a handful of people to go into the back room and switch it out, it being the nomination, the package of nominees inside the Democratic Party. He said it would be wrong for people to go into some back room, switch it out because they don't like the candidate any longer. He said on Monday that in some states, there are these impediments to just switching someone out like that. Well, Mr. Speaker, you're just plain wrong about that. And it is the considered view not only of lawyers on both sides of the political aisle, but also experts in this area of election politics who do this on a regular basis, that those kinds of statements are not only inaccurate, misleading, but they also convey some very bad civics when it comes to understanding how this works. Let's begin by addressing this notion that somehow there are some impediments right now in states across the country. In fact, just the opposite is true. An awful lot of surveying being done right now across the country of the 50 states and territories, including the District of Columbia, about whether or not this can happen. And the fact of the matter is that this also includes some of those seven states, including Wisconsin, with the closest margins in the 2020 election, likely also to be so-called battleground states here in the coming election as well. Key swing states like Georgia and Arizona, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, Michigan, Nevada, and yes, once again, Wisconsin. Those states include 15 where former President Donald Trump, the Republicans' 2024 nominee, had the highest share of the vote in 2020. The question, of course, what will happen in November, we don't know yet. But the question raised by Mike Johnson and others who suggest that somehow the Democrats are engaged in illegal conduct, again, no basis for that, just the opposite for it. All of them, all of these states are indicating that there is no impediment to the placement of Kamala Harris and her anticipated vice presidential nominee on the ballots in those states, principally because the nomination has not yet been accomplished. That's the big issue. Coming up August 19th through the 22nd in the city of Chicago, in the state of Illinois, just to the south of us here in the state of Wisconsin, that's the official nomination process. That's the time at which all of the delegates from the various primaries and caucuses from the past several months, they get together and they make that official nomination. And it may well be that there's going to be a nomination vote earlier, a virtual vote earlier in the month. None of that, contrary to state deadlines for receiving the party's nominees in sufficient time to get those names on the ballot. So let's sample some of the things that, again, some leaders, some spokespeople for the boards of elections in these various states have said, again, contrary to this notion that somehow there is something illegal or unconstitutional going on here. Petra Gannon, who is the spokesperson for the bipartisan North Carolina State Board of Electors, said this. He said political parties nominate their presidential and vice presidential candidates at their conventions, and then they inform the State Board of Elections of those persons' names. That's the process. The Democratic Party, he goes on to say, has not yet had its convention, nor has it informed the state board there in North Carolina of its presidential and vice presidential candidates' names. When they do so, Mr. Gannon said, those candidates' names will be placed on the ballot. And to a person, every other so-called leader of a state board of elections, somebody else who's responsible for the supervision of those elections in the various states, have affirmed that fundamental process. Gabriel Sterling, the chief operating officer for the Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger in Georgia, writes this on social media. He said, just so it's understood out there, Biden dropping out will not impact Georgia ballots. As the Democrats haven't had a convention, there is no nominee to replace. Once again, affirming what Patrick Gannon said out of North Carolina. Others, Chelsea Caratino, who's the spokesperson for the Idaho Secretary of State, said in an interview, there is no issue here. We basically just wait for the major parties to do their national conventions. And once they're completed, they send us their certificate of nomination for whomever is selected. Michonne Lindstrom, likewise, out of Kentucky, same kind of thing, affirms that fundamental notion that the process is going ahead, nothing irregular about this. And once the nomination is in place, that is when the names will be transmitted to these various secretaries of state for placement on the ballots. Now, another issue, if in fact those deadlines, those state deadlines are not met, but not here. When Amicus, a law review, continues, we're going to talk about some of the other legal problems with what Mike Johnson and others are saying and their proposed contests to what is going on here. All of that coming up on Amicus, a law review.
The Shaw, WAUK.
CBS News brief, former President Donald Trump wooing a conservative Christian conference his way, as CBS's Natalie Brand reports.
Trump again falsely claimed the 2020 election was rigged, and he urged conservative Christians to turn out to vote for him, saying just this time, notably telling the crowd that they don't have to vote again if he's elected.
Democrat rival Kamala Harris is off the campaign trail today.
Together we'll get through this and we will build back. And no matter what comes, we are not going to lose the enduring magic of Jasper.
That's Danielle Smith, Premier of Alberta province, after fire devoured one of the crown jewels in Canada's national park system. On the first full day of competition at the Paris Summer Games,
China took the first gold of the games. They've got two so far, but the Americans have won a medal. We've got silver right now in the 3-meter synchronized springboard competition. Sarah Bacon and Cassidy Cook with those honors.
CBS's Dana Jacobson, CBS News.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
Jordan Love has a new contract. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. Jordan Love has agreed to terms with the Green Bay Packers on a contract making him the highest paid quarterback in NFL history. 4 years, $222 million, and a record high signing bonus of $75 million, $155 million in guaranteed cash. The deal in Green Bay came down just hours after Love's agency, Athletes First, had completed a deal for Miami Dolphins quarterback Tua Tagovailoa, setting the bar for Jordan Love's contract. Brian Gutekunst.
He's our franchise quarterback, and we're ready to move forward. It's not like we're trying to make that decision. But at the same time, we want to put the best team around him we can. There's certainly the structure of it so that we can do what we need to do for our football team moving forward, not only this year, but years to come. So we got a lot of work to do. You know, we think we have a very good football team, but we got to come together as a team, and he's a big part of that. So him being out there is important for us.
Baseball, the Brewers losing at home last night to the Miami Marlins, 6-2. They'll play again tonight with sports. I'm Mike Clemens.
WAUK weather is sponsored by Planet X in Brookfield. Stocked with the freshest cigars at the best prices, 173rd and West Blue Mound Road.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, sunshine, highs in the upper 70s. Partly cloudy, 68 tonight. Slight chance of a thunderstorm for your Sunday with a high around 82. Scattered storms Sunday night, a low around 70, and a couple of thunderstorms possible on Monday. Otherwise, partly sunny with highs in the mid-80s.
It's 64 at our studios.
Introducing Brookfield's newest cigar and vape shop, Planet X. They have endless options with their wide variety of products. Experience luxury in their expansive cigar room, stocked with only the freshest cigars. And the best part? Planet X offers the cheapest prices in Brookfield. Open to serve you Monday through Saturday, 8 a.m. until midnight, and Sundays from 9 a.m. to 10 p.m. Come in today for cigars, vapes, and much more at Planet X.
Hi, I'm Emily from Weikert Realtors Lake Point in Madison. Home ownership is a big deal, and so is taking the leap into the buying or selling of any property. The Weikert team gets that, and our job is to help you navigate the sales process and provide smooth sailing. You have questions? We have answers. You have worries? We have solutions. Let us open the door to your future home. Weikert Realtors Lake Point, 608-721-8002, 2045 Atwood Avenue. Find more info at weikert-lakepoint.com.
Few Wisconsin events bring 600,000 people together from 80 different countries, but it happens every summer in Oshkosh.
Oshkosh has become synonymous with the world of flight and with EAA.
Dick Napinski's worked with EAA Air Venture for more than 30 years and knows its history. Do you? Where did EAA start? Wausau, La Crosse, or Milwaukee? The answer coming up. The fly-in is spread across 1,600 acres with more than 10,000 airplanes. It brings a big boost to the economy, too.
It's $170 million of economic impact and more than $110 million of direct spending.
So where did EAA start? Milwaukee in 1953 called the Wisconsin Air Pageant with 21 planes. All moved to Oshkosh in 1970. A high-flying slice of Wisconsin. It's happening July 22nd to the 28th. I'm Terry Barr.
Crude and Dom.
The Kamala Sugar High continues on the Devil's Advocates Radio Show, the very next one. But the ice picks are coming out for her. Tune in.
The Devil's Advocates, weekdays 4 till 6.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name, Jim Santel, your host for this hour and also next hour here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. Thank you once again for spending some time with me and my producer, Max, as we talk in the first portion of our discussion, our analysis this weekend about this notion, completely unfounded, that somehow there is something illegal, there's something unconstitutional even with the assumption by Kamala Harris of the nomination, the anticipated nomination of her at the Democratic convention in Chicago. Something wrong about this that one would need to run into court and stop it from happening. Well, let's begin to unpack that in addition to, as we said earlier, the problems with the timing on this, which is that the nomination has not yet been affirmed by the delegates who are properly sent to the convention. There's no nomination yet confirmed to switch out. It hasn't been done yet. Aside from that fundamental key impediment to believing in what Mike Johnson and others are saying these days about something wrong here, some back door, some back room where all of this is being done illegally. In addition to that, let's unpack some other concepts here that are simply belied by the representations made by the speaker and others. Initially begin with the notion fundamentally that political parties are not a part of government. Shouldn't have to say that out loud, but apparently some members of our leadership in the Capitol need to understand that. Political parties are private entities. Are they subject to laws? Sure they are. Federal Election Commission and other state laws, of course they are subject to state and federal laws, but they're not constitutionally created. George Washington, many of you will recall from your history books, very notoriously bemoaned the fact that the political parties were developing, even during the time of his presidency, a significant indication that in our Constitution, political parties are not established. They're not constitutional in nature. They're not, therefore, subject to all of the kinds of trappings that a government would. And so you do not have government officials making these decisions in political roles at these political parties. It is not government. It is a private political entity, the Democratic Party, the Republican Party, other parties out there. And significantly, what comes from that is that they've got associational aspects under the First Amendment, which we'll talk about. And they also have the capacity to write their own rules. We know that from history. We know that from recent conduct of our parties, that they can design as they want, because they're not subject to rules and regulations established by government and by even the Constitution, by statutory authority. They can make their own rules about how they select their candidates. And yes, indeed, contrary to what our speaker has said, if parties want to choose a candidate or a slate of candidates in a so-called smoke-filled backroom, they can do that. They can put together bylaws and rules and regulations about how they select their own candidates. Because they're political in nature, they are not governmental entities. And for that reason, that animates virtually everything else that flows from just that fundamental concept. And so the question becomes, can they sue? Can the people who don't like what's going on the Democratic side, can they sue? And whenever that question is asked in this setting and in other settings, I always say, really, you're asking two different questions. Can you sue? The answer is yes. You can walk into virtually any state or federal court on Monday morning and file lawsuits. And that's what's going on, presumably, in the present and anticipating the future as well. Probably some lawsuits being filed. You can walk into those clerks of court and you can file your civil complaint alleging certain improprieties, maybe following up on the baseless things being said about the legitimacy of what's going on inside the Democratic Party. The real question is not, can you sue? The question is, does that lawsuit have any merit to it? Will you be successful in the end? Or more charitably, is there an option? Is there a possibility that what you're alleging in that suit that you're bringing, that you've initiated in a federal or state court, has some legs to it, has some basis for going ahead? And there, on that issue, which is really what you're asking when you ask, can you sue? You're really asking, is there any merit to this? The answer is no. Will you be successful? Almost certainly not. There is simply no way that any of these lawsuits, present or future, will actually stop Vice President Harris from getting the nomination or getting on the ballot. And there's next to no way that they can also stop, that is, these lawsuits, stop her and her team her ultimate vice presidential nominee from using any of the funds that were already raised for the campaign which she has been a part of. The reality is that there's nothing, as we indicated in the timing of this, nothing in the rules that prevents this from going ahead. Indeed, the Democratic Party, like the Republican Party, other parties that meet, have great flexibility when it comes to establishing the mechanisms by which they select their candidates. And even in those instances in which, even after a nomination is confirmed at a convention, they've got rules which they can change if they want. Why? Because they're a political party. They're not a government that's subject to all of the strictures and the procedures and processes along the way. They can do that with great flexibility, is the rule. Parties have that capacity, once again, under their own rules. They can change their own rules if they choose to do so. It doesn't violate any law for a political party to nominate a presidential candidate. And you don't have a right. You don't have a right, whoever you are. You don't have standing, one might say. You don't have a right to insist on a particular candidate from another party or even from your own party. You've got to participate in the rules according to the parties as they have established those. And to present a plausible claim that a law has been broken in order to win a lawsuit, you've got to identify something that's in violation somehow of a particular federal or state law, and it simply isn't here. Significantly, as I indicated, there is a constitutional dimension of this, and that is that parties have a right under the First Amendment to associate. The First Amendment, of course, this fundamental notion about key elements of our Constitution, give you the right to assemble, to speak, freedom of the press, freedom of religion, no establishment of religion, no governmental interference in the conduct, the exercise of religion, and also this notion of association, understood always as providing all parties an associational right that gives them protection under the First Amendment to do not unfettered what they want to do, but under their own laws, their own regulations, their own rules to do that. There is a First Amendment dimension to this, an associational dimension that also prevents these lawsuits from going ahead. You don't have a right to compel an opposing party to nominate a particular nominee who you approve of or somehow want to have, nor do you have the right in some way to undermine what the party is doing just because you don't like it. And again, this notion of going into a federal or state court, you don't have that capacity either. And again, along the way, many people have indicated, let's assume that there is some claim here to make. The question again is, what injury? I mentioned before, standing, which is also sometimes invoked by our Supreme Court, lower courts, appellate courts, trial courts. What is the injury here? What's the remedy? Voters have no right to force Joe Biden to accept the nomination. And again, as I've indicated, no right to compel a particular set of nominees to be nominated. What happens? What happens in Chicago in a few weeks is that the delegates selected, again, according to the rules of the states and rules of the party, they assemble to make that nomination. And if during the course of that process, they choose to nominate a particular candidate, that's what they are required to do. That's the part of the process. The best reading of all of this indicates there's simply no indication that there is something problematic with this convention coming up, and no right to interrupt that based upon some governmental problem with what a party, in this case, the Democratic Party, is doing as it goes forward here. There's the second issue, of course, about money. Can, in fact, Kamala Harris use the funds that she along with Joe Biden, has already assembled in the course of this? And the answer, again, is almost certainly yes. Both political, legal observers across the board say that the one reason that Joe Biden specifically endorsed Kamala Harris was to answer any question, any remaining question, any legal issues about transferring over any campaign funds, if indeed you even have to make a transfer in the first place. The best reading of the Federal Election Campaign Act is that there are two people who can tap into the in excess of $100 million that's raised by the Biden-Harris campaign. One of them is named Joe Biden, and he is no longer a candidate. And the other is named Kamala Harris, and she obviously is. The analysis is that Kamala Harris can immediately get complete access to the money
raised by that Biden-Harris team. The money was raised for both of them. Admittedly, there's never been a set of facts just like this, but the right under the Federal Election Campaign Act to use those funds, quite clear. And again, the notion that somehow a lawsuit should prevent that use, which is legal and proper, is those lawsuits doomed to fail. Significantly, Biden's campaign committee on Sunday, shortly after he announced that his own candidacy would not be continued, they submitted some paperwork, some official documents that changed with the Federal Election Commission to change the name of the campaign to Harris for President. Also, no sleight of hand. They're simply confirming that's the candidate. That is the candidate who will be seeking the nomination in August in Chicago. And that is the candidate. She is the candidate who now has access to these funds. All of this entirely lawful for the campaign to change the name and to get access to that funding. And you've got prominent Democrats and Republicans, lawyers on both sides of this aisle, who is saying exactly just that. The reality is that there is nothing wrong with what's going on here. The freedom of association rights are complete. The capacity of the Democratic Party to identify, and even if it wants to change its own rules, that it can do without some violation of the democratic process. There's nothing illegal, nothing unconstitutional about that. There's no realistic prospect of anyone stopping the money from being used here. There's no realistic prospect of any of these lawsuits of being successful. Can they be filed? Will they be filed? Yes, almost certainly they will be. The significant question is, are there merits to them? And the answer there is no. There is simply no basis for going ahead with this. And yet, through the bad civics instruction of people like our Speaker of the House of Representatives, based upon things that he has inaccurately said, suggesting principally, I suppose, to his base and to others who like this sort of thing, that instead of spending some time talking about the merits of the candidacies, talking about the future of America, things in the areas of environment and education and commerce and the southern border and international issues, wars overseas, budget issues, all those kinds of things. Again, we're going to be spending time in the courts of our nation attempting to try to overturn something that hasn't yet been accomplished, but secondarily to attack through a process that is doomed to fail, a legitimate political mechanism. And all of that is troubling, not only from a civics perspective, but it also sends bad messages to people in all sides of the political aisle, and also suggests once again that these monies that are going to be used to pay lawyers to initiate these lawsuits, and yes, they come with fees not only to initiate the civil complaints, but also to pay the lawyers who will advocate on behalf of these unsupported bases, these unsupported theories, all of that takes money. We saw this once before. Arguably in a situation where the same thing happened after Donald Trump lost the 2020 election. He hired lawyers across the country to go into 60 different courts and to attempt to overturn what was clearly a legitimate election. In the end, every single one of those courts said the same thing. No violation of election procedures here. The 2020 election not stolen. Could you sue? Yes, indeed, you could. And the Trump campaign did. Donald Trump did file those lawsuits. Was he successful? No. The same thing applies here. The fact that you can sue does not mean that you'll be successful. And for that reason, it is disappointing at best. Charitably stated, disappointing that this may be the process that we're going to be pursuing now in the weeks, maybe months ahead, on both the capacity of Kamala Harris to become the nominee along with her vice presidential selection and also to access money that she is now adding to, by the way, in the course of her own pursuit of the presidential nomination. All of that not supported by the law, and yet encouraged by leadership in the Republican Party, perhaps others, who would try to throw wrenches in this process that is not, in fact, in any way flawed and is being pursued appropriately under the rules of the party and also the fundamental rules and regulations of the Federal Election Commission under the laws of our nation. As we continue here on Amicus Law Review, more on this and other stories in the area of law and government.
You're listening to The Shaw, WAUK, Waukesha's home for the Todd Allball Show.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
This whole week, I've been trying to think of some maneuver I could say that would go viral and totally sell my soul for extra cash. I'm not putting myself above that.
How about Schwabba Habba? Or Schwabby Dada? Or Schwabba Dabba Ding Dong? Instead of the more you know, it just says Schwabba Dabba Ding Dong with a rainbow and a star shooting star.
Conrad, I think we got our promo.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba. Weeknights 7 till 9 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
Hi, I'm Ryan Blaney, a third-generation race car driver, and I dedicate a lot of my time going fast. But when my grandpa was diagnosed with Alzheimer's, it was a very unexpected bump in the road for us. It's important to notice if older family members are acting differently or having trouble with routine tasks. Early detection of Alzheimer's can give your family time to explore support services and access available treatments. If you or your family are noticing changes, it could be Alzheimer's. Talk about seeing a doctor together. Visit alz.org/time to talk. A message from the Alzheimer's Association and the Ad Council.
This is the Shaw, WAUK.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name, Jim Santel, your host this hour and also next hour here on Civic Media, turning our attention to somewhat related issues, and that has to do with the Supreme Court. Spent a lot of time on this broadcast talking about these major decisions by the Supreme Court in recent weeks and months. Another significant development, of course, of the recent years is this issue of ethics. How is it that the members of the Supreme Court, the 9 justices, including the 8 associate justices and the chief justices, how are they conducting themselves both inside on the bench and also outside? And these issues focusing certainly principally upon Sam Alito and also Clarence Thomas, gifts they may have received, travel, vehicles, issues related to whether they should be presiding over cases at all, given their own involvements of their spouses in issues that may in fact be before the court. All of those issues that we have talked about a lot in the past, raising questions about whether or not the Supreme Court is operating ethically, whether it's got a code of conduct. It does not. And whether the Supreme Court justices who are responsible for these major decisions are doing things in a way that establishes not only their credibility, but their reputation among the population generally, all 334 million of us here in the United States and beyond who look to the Supreme Court to make these decisions absent bias, absent prejudice, absent conflicts of interest, absent the appearance of impropriety, raising issues about whether or not our Supreme Court is conducting itself appropriately. Just this past week, Justice Elena Kagan, one of the associate justices, we have heard from her a lot in recent times, was at the 9th Circuit Judicial Conference. Every year, every single appellate conference, every single appellate court gets together in a convention, if you will, a conference. They get together and the 7th Circuit gets together in Chicago. The justices, the judges from the various appellate court and from the district court in Wisconsin and Illinois and Indiana gather together with the associate justice from the Supreme Court, who is assigned to that particular appellate court. Ours is Amy Coney Barrett. Elena Kagan is assigned to the 9th Circuit Court of Appeals. That includes that great swath of geography out there in the West. It includes California. Got together just this past week in that so-called convention or conference. Elena Kagan interviewed during the course of that proceeding. A public interview. The judges get together, the justices get together from the 9th Circuit, and they talk about administration of the courts and the ways in which the courts can work better. Attorneys also attend in the very public settings of that process. And along the way, Elena Kagan, once again interviewed this past Thursday, talking about this issue of ethics and a code of conduct. She specifically said that there needs to be a way to enforce the rules for them to become more effective. Significant that Elena Kagan is candidly speaking about this issue publicly off the bench. She said, I think that the rules that we put out there are good ones, but I think that the thing that can be criticized is, as she said, you know, rules usually have enforcement mechanisms attached to them. And this one, she said, this set of rules does not. Interesting. Now, she's talking about not an ethics code,
although she makes reference to that in that way. But you may recall that back in November, under pressure from the Congress, under pressure from the public, from the media generally, the Chief Justice did issue this amalgam, this sort of composition that brought together a different number of different principles and concepts, some of them previously established, articulating aspirations for how the members of our Supreme Court should act when it comes to recusals in cases, their own behavior on the bench, off the bench. And it's sometimes referred to an ethics code, but it really isn't an ethics code. Why? Among other things, it doesn't establish an ethics set of principles in the way that the lower courts are compelled to follow one, the appellate courts, the district courts. And second, as Elena Kagan affirmed and conceded just this past week, it doesn't have an enforcement mechanism. All the principles in the world, all the standards in the world that you can identify are meaningless if, in fact, they somehow can be enforced at the lower court levels, the appellate court, the district court levels around our country, including right here in the Seventh Circuit, the appeals court in Chicago, the district courts in Indiana, Illinois, and Wisconsin. All of those have ethics codes that are indeed enforceable. And as Elena Kagan said in California just this past week, the one coming out from the Supreme Court just this past November does not have that kind of a thing. Again, she makes these comments during a wide-ranging conversation, but for an audience of who? Of judges and lawyers at this Ninth Circuit Judicial Conference, making the first public appearance of the nine justices since the court wrapped up this historic and very contentious session earlier this month, resulting in some of these major cases, two of which we're also going to be revisiting in this broadcast of Amicus Law Review. Kagan on Thursday called the criticism of this so-called code that was released fair. And she went on to say that she thought the best enforcers of it for the Supreme Court would be, get this, lower court judges, but not the justices themselves. This is what she said. She says, I can't think of other people who should enforce a code of conduct against judges. And I think it would be quite bad for us to do it to each other. In other words, she said, for the same judges who are sitting around the table trying to decide cases, to be the people who are saying, oh no, you broke that rule or you didn't break that particular rule. In other words, self-enforcement is not the process, she says. In order to do this, Elena Kagan says, the Chief Justice, John Roberts, should look elsewhere in the federal judiciary. She goes on to say just this, I feel as though, however hard it is, we could and should try to figure out some mechanism for doing this. She said, I have a lot of trust in and faith in the Chief Justice. The Chief Justice appointed should appoint some sort of committee, highly respected judges with a great deal of experience, with a reputation for fairness. That seems like a good solution to me. She said she was just sharing her own opinion. I'm not intimating anything here, but suggesting that there needs to be this enforcement as a part of what's going on here with ethics and calling upon other judges, other federal judges, to be the ones that enforce this on behalf and for the nine members of the Supreme Court. Fascinating concept here coming out of Elena Kagan just this past week. In our second hour, we're going to talk a little bit more about Elena Kagan said in some other areas as our discussion continues here on Amicus Law Review of the Supreme Court and indeed other appellate courts in our nation making news just this past week in many important ways affecting our lives and our livelihoods.
You're listening to The Shaw at WAUK, Waukesha's home for the Devil's Advocates radio show.
Earl Ingram.
Tune into the next show. It's Motown Monday. We'll react to the news from the weekend and talk about the issues impacting us all.
The Earl Ingram Show, weekday mornings 8 till 10.
Jazz up your week with the many opportunities to enjoy music at Cutler Park.
Jazza Cutler is featuring Marsha Daniel and her combo on Wednesday, July 24th, starting at 8 p.m. at the Les Paul Performance Center. Following on Thursday, July 25th at Les Paul Performance Center, Jazz Express is playing at 8 p.m. Stop by to tap your feet to the jazzy tunes from the big band era. It's great music and tons of fun for the summer. Jazz up the week at Cutler Park.
You're listening to The Shaw.
WAUK 540 AM Jackson. W266 DR Waukesha.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.